Welcome to On Deadline, a deep dive into a single topic from Odyssey's newsrooms across the country. When Harry met Sally, when Bogart met Bacall, those are historic moments for many Americans. But will, when Trump met Putin in Alaska, shape up to be another? We'll find out later because the meeting is set to happen today, which is Friday, August 15th, 2025. What should we expect? Here's the Moscow Bureau Chief for CBS News, Beth Noble, to kick things off.
What do you make of having it in Alaska?
Well, it's sort of an interesting spot, isn't it, Eric? Because technically, Vladimir Putin is under sanctions and is not supposed to visit the United States at all, where, you know, technically he could face arrest. So obviously that's not going to happen. But, you know, it's symbolic, isn't it, that Alaska is a territory that the Americans purchased from Russia, you know, more than 100 years ago. So it seems like some interesting middle ground. And, you know, maybe it's symbolic that President Trump is trying to find some middle ground with President Putin.
We just had a news alert cross out of Berlin from the Associated Press, the German chancellor saying that European leaders and Zelensky had a, quote, constructive meeting with Trump about Ukraine. But Zelensky will not be in attendance. So how do you see his interests being presented?
So one of the things that President Trump said when he first announced that there was going to be this meeting with President Putin is that President Trump wanted it to be the first meeting. So he envisions that he'll sit down with President Putin, kind of have a listening session, perhaps maybe make some proposals. And then if things go well, there'd be a second meeting with President Zelensky present as well. We don't know if that's going to happen. There's no indication yet whether President Zelensky is going to fly to Alaska to be standing by in case President Putin agrees to see him when he agrees to see President Putin. It's kind of unclear what's going to happen next. But European leaders and President Zelensky are all very, very worried about what might happen in that meeting. And they're trying to make it clear to President Trump that he can't cut a deal with President Putin to end the war in Ukraine without Ukraine being across it. And also European leaders giving their permission, because it's very likely that they're going to be involved in trying to keep the peace.
The phone calls between President Trump and Putin have been characterized as monologues by Mr. Putin. What do you expect to happen when they meet face to face? You told us last week that Putin is very good at reading people.
Oh, yeah. He's a former KGB agent, and that's what he does for a living, is read people and maybe tell them what they want to hear, or maybe tell them what he wants to say. So it's really unclear what's going to happen. And in their previous meeting, the two, which took place, their big summit, it happened in Helsinki in 2018. We're told that the two presidents met alone, just with interpreters, with no one to take notes, no one to whisper in their ears about things that they were saying that may or may not have been true, or what the other person might have been saying. So we don't even know the format for this coming meeting. But I think it's very realistic that President Trump should really be on his toes and be very careful and listen to President Putin, but take what he's saying with a grain of salt, or maybe many grains of salt.
And both Trump and Putin have floated the exchange of land, territories. Is this a deal breaker for Zelensky?
Well, you know, we don't know what will happen. I mean, one of the things that President Zelensky has said all along is that he doesn't want to give Russia any of Ukraine, but he certainly doesn't want to give pieces of Ukraine that Russia has not even occupied. And so one of the things that Russia has been pushing for is that it has partial control of some Ukrainian territories, you know, kind of like regions that are like our states, that he has partial control of some states and is like, well, what we really want is the whole state. And so Ukraine is like, well, why would we do that? We don't even want to give you the pieces of our states that you occupy now. So there's so many issues that they have to figure out. I think a peace deal here is possible, and a lot of people want it, including, you know, certainly the Ukrainian people are really sick of being attacked. But getting to yes on this deal is going to be very, very complicated, even for an experienced dealmaker like President Trump.
CBS News military analyst Jeff McCaughlin is next up, and he's discussing some of the finer points of the meeting.
They're going to have a meeting with just their translators first. Is that unusual?
It's a little bit unusual and a little bit concerning, quite frankly, that Mr. Trump has done this in the past. One might remember back in 2019, he met with Mr. Putin at Helsinki. He did the same thing and then came out to a press conference and made a rather stunning announcement saying that Putin had told him that the Russians had not interfered in the 2016 elections, and Mr. Trump accepted that as to be true. That was, as he made that statement, in that hall were representatives of U.S. intelligence services, all of which had prepared reports showing clearly that the Russians had interfered in U.S. elections. And furthermore, there was a subsequent report by the Senate signed off by his current Secretary of State, Mr. Rubio, that in fact the Russians had had affected our election. So a little concerning when the president has that private kind of meeting with only translator and doesn't have somebody else in the room that can say, no, no, Mr. Trump didn't say that, or Putin did say this. So that's a little bit of a worry.
What specific proposals for a peace deal will be on the table?
Well, I think the first of all is Mr. Trump has already said that we're going to talk about land swaps, but it's unclear to me what those land swaps mean, because all the land we're talking about is Ukrainian land that has been seized by the Russians since they invaded in 2022. So as a consequence, if you recall yesterday, there was a meeting, virtual meeting involving all European leaders chaired by the German chancellor. Mr. Zelensky was there to talk to Mr. Trump about the insistence that there had to be security guarantees in any final agreement to guarantee Ukrainian security. And furthermore, an insistence that while the Russians want to negotiate a final settlement of territory and then move to a ceasefire, what Mr. Trump should insist upon is a ceasefire to begin with and then a beginning of negotiations on various topics.
So what role will Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his government play in the discussions, given that they're not directly participating in the summit?
Yeah, that's their concern. You know, Margie, there's a saying in Washington, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And that is the concern of the Ukrainians. Frankly, I think it's the concern of the Europeans. You know, Europeans think long about history. And they'll recall that in 1945 at Yalta, ironically, in the Crimea, Franklin Roosevelt, an American president, met a Soviet Russian leader, Joseph Stalin, along with Winston Churchill. And they divided up the map of Europe and basically locked countries away into being occupied by the Soviet Union, being part of their sphere of influence for many, many, many decades. So they worried that this might happen again. Or they might point out to you, as some have to me, back in 1938, when, of course, Neville Chamberlain, a superpower at the time in Great Britain, will negotiate with Adolf Hitler the fate of Czechoslovakia. And the Czechs were not present at those tables as well. So that is a concern by Zelensky, a concern by the Europeans. I think that's why that meeting yesterday was held virtually with the allies and Zelensky coming out of Berlin to try to emphasize that point to Mr. Trump.
What are the potential very severe consequences that President Trump has threatened Russia if an agreement is not reached?
Well, he's talked about major sanctions against the Russians, but the Russians will brush that off because, frankly, there's very little economic interchange between the United States and the Russian Federation. I don't even think it amounts to $2 billion a year right now. But the real problem would be, of course, secondary sanctions. If, in fact, Mr. Trump was to go through with those threats, which would be sanctions on India, those have been threatened, and China. And the reason those are important is because those two countries import large amounts of Russian oil and natural gas, which buttresses the Russian economy, as do other countries like Turkey and Brazil, as well as the continuation of current Russian sanctions. He might also decide that the United States will continue to provide and prioritize military assistance to Ukraine, even if it is in the format that we're doing right now, where the Europeans purchase it and then provide to the Ukrainians. And furthermore, he probably could emphasize that the United States will continue to provide intelligence assistance to the Ukrainians as they use that to target Russians and Russian aggression against Ukraine.
CBS News Major Garrett has tips for signals from Putin that people should be watching for during the meeting.
Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, face-to-face on a number of topics, but mainly the war between Russia and Ukraine. The president spoke to the media today and talked about a phone call that he had with President Zelensky, European leaders, and said the call was a very good call. In fact, he rated it a 10 as he's meeting with those folks before he meets with Putin. He says, if it goes well, There'll be a second meeting very quickly where Zelensky would be included with himself and Putin. You know this man very well. You've covered him. You understand the implications of this meeting. What are the big issues? What are the areas to watch leading up to it and watching it after when the president addresses it?
Well, very simply, if there is a new Russian offensive leading up to it, that's very bad. That's fronting Trump off in a very direct way and killing more Ukrainians. And Zelensky has warned about this. He says, we see troop movements, preparation for an offensive. Now, that could just be muscle flexing of the Russians to sort of intensify maybe the Ukrainians' desire for peace. I don't think that's going to work, but it's definitely a flex to talk as the kids do. The other thing to watch is if there can be an agreement that has any validity, and I stress the any validity part, to a ceasefire. Because the Ukrainians have agreed to ceasefire terms, the Russians haven't. Now, the Russians might, and President Trump might say they agreed to a ceasefire, and then the Russians could interpret the living up to that ceasefire fundamentally differently than the Ukrainians and the Americans. And there's a history for this. So ceasefire is second, no offensive either right up to or right after the Alaska meeting. Those are the two things to keep an eye on.
Zelensky has continued to say throughout this, we want all of our country.
Of course.
Want all of our land.
Of course.
That we're not accepting any of these trades. The president has been very outspoken about that, including the days leading up this about possible land trades. And
right.
Clearly Putin wants that. From your sourcing within CBS News, with their conversation with the other people close to Zelensky or Zelensky directly, is he just saying that, or is he willing to accept some loss of land to end this war?
Well, nobody at CBS News knows what Zelensky is ultimately willing to accept. We don't have those kind of sources. I don't think anyone does. I don't think the Ukrainian press does. I don't think anyone in the major European capitals who cover the story aggressively hour by hour have any idea of what he will ultimately accept if he has to accept. And I know the way the president thinks. He talks about land swaps, looking to the Ukrainians and say, look, if I get the Russians to swap out something they've already taken by military force, you better grab it because you can't get it and I might get it for you. Will you have to give up things that the Russians already occupy and you can't dislodge them from? Probably. But if I'm giving you something back and you're only exchanging it for things you've already lost, maybe that's not such a bad deal. President Trump thinks in highly transactional and sometimes brilliantly simplistic ways. Not always, but sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't want to suggest otherwise. He does have a way of simplifying things to their absolute essence and talking about them out loud because he's like, I'm not going to dance around this stuff. We don't know what he is or isn't dancing around or what the contours of this will be. But anyone in Zelensky's position can only say one thing right now, which is you get nothing.
Yeah.
You can say nothing less than that
right.
until you're forced to say something different. Once you understand what the getting back part of it is, and you can break this down very easily. There's Crimea and the Donbas. The Russians have it. They're probably not going to give it up. But
they're not going to.
There is Zaporizhia. There is the Donetsk. Those are things that they partially occupy that the Ukrainians want and that they get some of that back or most of that back. That's not. I'm not saying it's good, but unless you want this war to continue endlessly, this may be something that the Ukrainians may be forced to accept as a compromise. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a internationally legal thing. By no means is it, but sometimes you have to accept what you can't otherwise achieve, and we may be approaching that level of specificity. But then the next layer of this is. And this is really the hardest part, and it's the most stomach-churning part of this. Let's say, for the sake of argument, abstractly, the Russians are in Crimea and the Donbas,
mm-hmm.
and they stay there. and they get a little bit of Donetsk and Zaporizhia, but the Ukrainians get some of it back. Okay, so they sit there. The Russians sit there. And for some period of time, there are European security forces monitoring this line. They're probably lightly armed. They probably have very specific, highly technical 17 pages worth of engagement orders, what they can and can't do. Meanwhile, the Russians retrofit, reorganize their strength, get better generals, put more stuff there, and they're basically poised to invade whenever they want. And everyone knows that that little group of European security enforcers are no match.
Yes.
And then Ukraine lives in constant fear and peril. That's the other part of this story. That's the stomach-churning part of it, which is why Zelensky can say nothing else than, you get nothing. And even if he's forced to accept something less than that, that creates all manner of traumas going forward.
President Donald Trump wrote a book called The Art of the Deal. But what negotiating tactics does he have planned for this potentially historic meeting with the Russian leader? Newell Normand at WWL Radio in New Orleans has some suggestions.
All right, folks, we're back with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. A very consequential meeting that could be had Friday. Tell us your thoughts.
No doubt about it, Newell. This could be, as you said, the most consequential meeting, certainly, that we've had with the Russians. That might bring this war to some kind of a ceasefire or conclusion. The war's gone on for over 3 years now. And really, we're bringing Mr. Putin out of isolation in many, many ways. But, you know, there's really, I think, a lot of concern. And something you said at the top, I think, needs to be underscored. And that is, you never go into a meeting like this at this level without the willingness to say no. Otherwise, you can be manipulated. And I think one of the most stunning negotiations that were similar was, of course, when Ronald Reagan beat Gorbachev in Iceland, I think in 1987, if I am correct, to negotiate deep reductions in nuclear forces. They were moving very close to a deal. At the last minute, Gorbachev said to Reagan, well, we can't sign this unless you now also agree something new, that you will not construct your missile defenses, so-called Star Wars. And Reagan looked at him and said, no. And he walked away. So many people call that a failure. I actually think that was a success because Reagan stuck to his guns on what he thought was essential for the United States. In this case, I think Mr. Trump needs to stick off on a focus that's pretty binary. And that is, we want a ceasefire. We want a ceasefire right now. And once we got that, then we're happy to negotiate perhaps anything you want to talk about. And Mr. Putin wants it the other way around. He wants to negotiate territorial swaps. Oh, by the way, those swaps are all for Ukrainian territory. I don't know what the Ukrainians are getting. They don't own any Russian territory. Recognition that they'll not be a member of NATO, reduction in their military forces, no peacekeeping, no presence, no joining NATO. He basically wants to make it into a satellite of the Russian Federation. He wants that up front as a precondition to going to a ceasefire. So hopefully Mr. Trump understands that this is a binary choice. If need be, he needs to say no.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that the Russians have characterized this. I was watching Russian TV the other day, and there was a military guy, I can't remember his name. I can't pronounce many of them's name, but anyway.
I understand.
Yeah. Ukrainians are like family to us. Ukraine did not leave us. The West stole them. And I'm listening to this rhetoric, and I'm like, what the hell are these people talking about?
Well, they forget a lot of history. I mean, quickly, if you go back to the end of the Soviet Union in 1991, it was the Union of Socialist Republics, plural. And they would say, that's what we are. And in 1991, the Soviet Union dissolved. We know that. Those leaders of all those republics met in Tashkent, and they agreed on the dissolution, and they agreed on the borders. And the Russian Federation accepted what the border was between what was the Ukraine and what was the Russian Federation. They agreed. They signed off on that. The Ukrainians would subsequently transfer all the nuclear weapons that were on their territory to the Russian Federation. In return, they were provided in the Budapest Memorandum guarantees by the Russians, by the United States, and by the United Kingdom that Ukrainian sovereignty would be respected. That didn't work. Didn't happen. And the Russians in 2014 will invade. They will seize Crimea, and they will instigate a war in the Donbass, which would kill over 10,000 people. They would sign two accords called the Minsk I and Minsk II, again, recognizing the territorial integrity of Ukraine. Did they agree to that? Sure they did. Did they respect that? Nope. And they invaded again in 2022. So if you're Mr. Zelensky, All this discussion of territorial swaps is incredibly uninteresting. What you want to talk about is security guarantees. Security guarantees. How do we put in place measures whereby Ukraine can maintain its sovereignty as a country and deter or prevent the Russians from doing this again? Because, as you rightly point out, for many Russians, Mr. Putin included, this is Russian territory. And way back in 2009, Putin would meet with George Bush when he was president in Romania at a NATO conference and tell him, well, you know, George, Ukraine, there's no such thing as Ukraine. And even very recently, as late as late June, Putin has said the same thing in speeches and his aspirations to make it part of the Russian Federation. And in essence, what Putin's ultimate goal is, he wants to be Peter the Great and reestablish the territory of the Russian Empire. This is not about the Soviet Union or communism or anything. This is all about Russian nationalism.
So it would seem to me, Colonel, and you've said this many times, you look at most recent human behavior, right, as displayed by Putin. So if you look at the way that they have been reacting, and specifically President Putin, as it relates to things that are going on in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Two of those, Lithuania and Latvia, for the benefit of the audience, they're NATO members. Estonia is not. Recently,
Estonia is too. I'm sorry.
No, they are now.
You, but not, oh, yes, sir. They certainly are.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Sir.
I thought they were still on the outside looking in. Well, that's
that makes
it even more interesting, right, in many respects. Recently, they engaged in this evacuation pact of these Baltic countries, and this is very important to them because they're very concerned about what the West's response is going to be Friday. You know, and they knew that they were going to come here. These countries are very, very small. Wouldn't take much for
on
Russia.
On the border of Russia.
You know, and kind of has their northern front isolated. And it's interesting the dialogue that's going on there all the while that this is going on here. And I think it telegraphs exactly what you just talked about. He wants to put all of this together. There's no doubt about that. I mean, so
no, there's none.
To engage
and you,
in a land swap is... You know, it's like, what? Why would we even want to do that? I mean, I think I'd start the meeting off with no.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this goes back to 2014. President Putin, at the time, will give a speech, which an annual speech to the Russian people, which Russian presidents do. And he would say in that speech that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the end of the Soviet Union. Now you're going to go, wait a minute. This is a country that lost 35 million people in World War II, and you're saying the greatest tragedy was the end of the Soviet Union? That was the worst thing that ever happened to you? And since then, the Russians have consistently, and I think it's funny because they consistently say this, and we just kind of skip over it. They talk about what they call, and Putin used this phrase, Ruski Mir, which means the Russian world. And then they talk about what they call the near abroad. And what Putin has said repeatedly is where there are Russians, there is Russia. So if there are people who identify or speak Russian, then that territory is Russian. Now, we heard a guy who said that before, as I recall, well, I'm a little bit of a historian. Back in the 1930s, seemed there was this guy in Germany that kind of talked about the same thing, you know?
Yeah. So vaguely remember him.
Vaguely remember that guy. So that betrays to you his aspirations. And then if you're those countries, or you're NATO more broadly, or the Ukrainians, you know, there's a saying in diplomacy, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu, okay? And that's what their concern is, okay? They witnessed Yalta, 1944-45. Roosevelt will meet with Stalin and Churchill in Yalta, in the Crimea, oddly enough, and basically divide up the map of Europe. They remember Munich, when in 1938, Neville Chamberlain will negotiate over the heads of the Czechs and give away Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler and to Germany. They remember that. And so they get this sort of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra used to say, when they see this kind of stuff going on and the superpowers negotiating on the future of their territory and their population.
Yeah, I mean, I guess also you would be very suspicious, right, with the most recent offensive that they've engaged in the eastern Donetsk area.
To try
and create a new high, I guess you could call it a new high watermark, I guess, you know.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, and be willing to negotiate a little bit backwards from there. You know, that this is all about territory, and it's not about anything other than territory this time, and then who knows how much next time.
Yeah, it's about territory and sovereignty. And again, the Russians may become convinced that they've lost a million casualties, 100,000 dead. Russians, we need to understand, have suffered more casualties in the war in Ukraine than the United States suffered in World War One. Okay, so I think that's what one of our problems in wrapping our heads around this. That we say, well, if we'd suffered that, we would be looking for some way to negotiate an end to all this. Okay, but I'm here to tell you, because of their belief and Putin's belief and his attitudes and his nationalistic fervor, he'll spend another million Russians. Won't bat an eye. Okay, to do that. And he also knows as a negotiator, if I can improve my position on the battlefield shortly before the negotiations start, then that puts me in a little bit better position for the negotiations. And that's exactly what they're trying to accomplish in the Donbass, in the eyes of the West, in the eyes of the Ukrainians. That being said, as a military guy, I'm somewhat skeptical that this is more anything more than some tactical success that they have achieved. We're talking small units using drones for air interdiction. They've taken maybe 10, 15 kilometers, maybe have opened a gap, but it's unclear to me if they have a gap, how big the gap is. Frankly, even most importantly, do the Russians have operational reserve, sufficient that they could exploit that type of a penetration into the Ukrainian line? Remains to be seen. We'll see over the next couple of days. And finally, back to land swap. He wants Ukrainians to give away this territory. That territory is not just territory of Ukraine, you know, per se. It is also this defensive belt that the Ukrainians have developed over the last 3 years. It's their primary defensive belt, which is tied to rivers and key terrain. And so he wants the Ukrainians basically to unilaterally retreat from that, see that the Russian Federation, which would put them even in the aftermath, in the quote-unquote best of circumstance, now reestablishing their defensive positions on much less defensive terrain. So it also has a really big military connotation in terms of that land swap beyond just territory and population.
If nothing gets accomplished this Friday, what do you expect the reaction of NATO and European countries to be? They seem to have been a little bit more aggressive and proactive in this previous 10 days leading up.
Well, we still coming out of the NATO summit was unity of NATO. And the other thing I think we need to keep in mind, Putin, one of his objectives is not only to win in a negotiation, something that he couldn't win so far on the battlefield. That's his objective. But his longer-term objective, along with, you know, the recreation of the empire, is to damage, if not destroy, NATO, which has been an objective of every Russian Soviet leader back to Joe Stalin. So if I can use this issue to drive a wedge between the United States and its European allies, that is a tremendous strategic. So the alliance was unified in the aftermath of the summit about a month or so ago. Remains to be seen whether that will be the case in the aftermath. But I think the Europeans, I talked to them a lot, have woken up to the reality of what Mr. Putin aspires to do, number one. And number two, that the United States, frankly, is not going to be part of this in terms of at least financial support. Mr. Trump did agree to provide weapons, but those weapons have to be purchased by the Europeans, provided to Ukraine. We provide certain key things to the Ukrainians that cannot be provided by the Europeans, most notably intelligence targeting, which is essential to them, and a lot of our ballistic missile defense capabilities, Patriot, is really essential to the Ukrainians. The Europeans don't have anything right now that is similar to that. So the willingness of the Ukrainians, or the Europeans, I'm sorry, to pick up the financial load of military assistance to Ukraine and continue that, even if the United States kind of walks away from this, is the key question. My feeling right now is that they are prepared to do that. Whether or not they can sustain that, if this now goes on for a year, 2 years, who knows, longer, that remains to be a question.
So, short of asking you to kind of grab the psyche of Trump, I'm not sure who's capable of doing that. But,
yeah,
you know, I mean, we have sanctions sitting out there that we could get a lot more aggressive and basically, for all intents and purposes, pretty go a long way in annihilating the economy of Russia, right? I mean, there are just a few pieces and parts that need to fall into place for that to ultimately happen. Do we have the stomach for it? Can we pull that off? Because it would seem to me that that might be the most successful path to getting to some resolution and willingness to be a little bit more reasonable in these negotiations.
Yeah, again, that remains to be seen. I mean, from the onset, we have to remember Mr. Trump, not to get into his psyche, just hearing his words, campaigned on ending this war in a single day. And then he was inaugurated, and that's been about, you know, 200 days ago, and nothing's happened. In the interim, just to tick off quickly, he has made significant concessions trying to be known as a peacemaker in the Ukraine. He has publicly said, or his administration said, we will now object to Ukraine joining NATO. He has recognized Russian control over Crimea and said that we would actually formally recognize that in the aftermath. He has said Ukraine must lose territory. He has said no U.S. troops will be involved in any peacekeeping operation. he paused, at least for a time, any kind of offensive cyber operations by the United States against the Russian Federation. He ended Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which made the Moscow delighted. He has talked about Putin being allowed to return to the G7, removal of all sanctions. He has ended military aid, though we're going to provide military assistance for sale. And he's ended the effort to monitor disappearance of literally thousands of Ukrainian children who've been taken into the Russian Federation, and also berated the International Court for indicting Putin for war crimes. Those are just a short list of the concessions we've made so far. What have we gotten in return for that? I don't know, Newell. Maybe you can help me. And then last Friday was a deadline for those sanctions you point out to go into place, 100% sanctions against Russia, secondary sanctions most notably on China and India, who purchased an enormous amount of Russian oil. And on Friday, the deadline came and went. And what happened? Mr. Putin got rewarded. He got rewarded with a summit, which for him is a reward, an invitation to the United States, an invitation to meet with the President of the United States, bringing him in out of the cold in terms of his isolation. And trust me, this has played out, and you probably saw it on Russian TV when you're watching.
Oh, it's horrible.
A major success. Major success. Yeah. So with all that in mind, you know, what can you do? I think the sanctions you talked about, right now in the United States Senate, there is a bipartisan bill which has the bipartisan support of 85 senators. I didn't think you'd get 85 American senators to agree on what time of day it is. But 85 senators support a bill to put unbelievably large sanctions on the Russian Federation and sanctions against those countries that provide or purchase oil and natural gas. That is being held until Mr. Trump tells the majority leader to put it to the floor. And if he says no, it will never, ever go to the floor. And so I think that is the leverage if you want to move the Russians towards negotiations. But it's unclear to me so far, quite honestly, and I'm just reading what's going on, whether Mr. Trump can translate rhetoric into actual action and pressure. Because so far we've made concessions and gotten nothing.
Yeah, I mean, because I really believe that the test, the more I read, I really believe if we make any of these territorial concessions to Putin here, the next step is going to be in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And,
sure.
they're going, you know, they're already messing with those folks on a daily basis now. It's going to be a little bit more aggressive, and it's going to be all about testing NATO, in my
yep.
view. And, you know, and unless and until, you know, somebody is going to step up somewhere, somehow, and say no, we're going to continue to fall prey to this strategy, and you tell me if I'm wrong, you know, of the utilization of nuclear weapons, which I don't know that he's got that move in his bag, quite frankly, because the response to that would be a definitive annihilation of Russia. And I'm not sure that China or North Korea or anybody else is going to step up and assist in that regard. If I was a betting man, I'd say no, right or wrong. Yeah, your thoughts.
No, I think you're right. I mean, we have to be respectful and obviously acknowledge the Russian Federation is the only country that has a nuclear arsenal that can really destroy the United States at any time. And we have arms control agreements that basically verify a sort of a parity of nuclear weapons between us and the Russian Federation. The Chinese have a force that's about a third to a half the size of either arsenal. So that's not an insignificant thing. And Mr. Putin has rattled his nuclear saber on a couple of occasions. And one has to keep an eye on that and make sure that you do this in a deliberate fashion. I don't think he's willing to go to nuclear war over a portion of Lithuania, though,
right,
for the reasons that you actually described. And then furthermore, you're correct that, you know, in many ways, and if you talk to people in the so-called frontline state, Poles, Baltic Republic, Finns, Swedes, people like that, who have borders with the Russian Federation, they would tell you, we're at war right now. You know, we're under continuous cyber attacks, hybrid warfare, which is things like disruption of undersea cables that connect the Internet and energy sources across the Baltic Sea, criminal activity, unexploded explosions at airports. That's been going on in all those places for quite some time. The Poles even formally identified that the Russian Federation were behind attacks that were occurring in Poland. So that is occurring right now. And if Putin is successful in what he's doing, there's no reason why one can't believe that he might not accelerate that. Now, that being said, would that happen immediately? My guess is probably not, because of the number of the casualties the Russian Federation has taken, but their playbook would be, okay, let's take a year or so to kind of recover from this conflict, consolidate our positions in the Ukraine, and then slowly but surely move on from there. And then last but not least, don't forget that we're talking about international norms that we're just going to walk away from. I always come back to the previous Japanese prime minister who, when he visited Kyiv, stood in the streets of Kyiv with the president, Mr. Zelensky, and gave a speech in which he said, if you really want to deter Chinese aggression in the Pacific, then you have to be successful in Ukraine. Because if you walk away from this, then why wouldn't the Chinese say, well, they're clearly, then that's a clear signal for us that we can move on Taiwan anytime we feel like it.
Yeah, no doubt. I will love to have you back after this plays out on Friday. It's going to be very interesting. The president said again today he'll know within the first 2 minutes of sitting down with Putin whether or not he's serious about this. He may very well be serious, but he's seriously thinking about more land, more territory. That I know for certain.
One quick comment on that. I think what I'm seeing happening right now, Newell, I think is a concerted effort in the White House to dial down expectations. I mean, we're talking about this as a listening thing now. We're talking about I'll know in 2 minutes. I mean, witness the fact that it's my understanding there's no schedule that's been presented. This is the most hastily put together summit I can recall in my lifetime. And if they meet, and you're in the news, if they meet about and walk out of the meeting about 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon in Anchorage, Alaska, it's 8 o'clock at night in New Orleans, and who cares, right?
Right. Yeah. No. Well, I mean, I've read about all that you outlined about what's going on with Finland and, all of the northern front of Russia, all of those countries, right? And how they've been screwing with them daily. You don't see any of that in the mainstream media in the United States. It's not hardly even written about. It's not talked about what's going on. And I think the whole psyche of the U.S. would be different if we were aware of all of that's going on and what they're actually doing. I may be wrong, but I just think it would be.
It could be. The only thing you and I can do is the best we can.
Yeah. Colonel, as always, truly enjoy the conversation. Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.